Welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Frederick Turner, who is Founders Professor of Literature and Creative Writing at UT Dallas, and the author of nearly 40 books, including epic poetry, cultural criticism, drama, aesthetics and philosophy of science, studies of Shakespeare, and poetry and translation, including, most recently, with Zsuzsanna Osvat, Faust and Other Poems by Goethe, as well as the recipient of numerous awards and prizes. Thank you very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I wanted to begin by asking you about science and the way that you use science to explain and illuminate aspects of culture is really fascinating. And I thought I would ask if were you always interested in science as a subject, or how did that begin for you?
I was always interested. I mean, part of it is that my brother Bob was when we were kids, he was a botanist. Uh-huh. And I didn't have the sort of patience to do the kind of collecting. I'm not a collector,
right.
And that sort of thing. But I was very interested in what you might call sort of the general ideas
right.
I suppose I was having some kind of Goethean thought about the Urpflanz or something.
Uh-huh.
And then my father, of course, Bob eventually he became a physicist, and then he also did a degree in anthropology, and then became very distinguished in he was one of the people that developed magnetic resonance imaging,
yeah,
and did a whole lot of work looking at the human brain.
Wow.
And that itself was partly inspired by work that I had done on poetic meter,
uh-huh,
and that my father, Vic Turner, had, yeah, done on, in his later years, he began to become more and more interested,
yeah,
in the in a sense, the biological roots of human,
yeah,
ritual.
Yeah.
Because one of his great discoveries was, I suppose you could say, the universality of ritual,
right,
certain ritual themes and ritual practices. And so, you know, the conclusion might be that this was something which wasn't just a mere cultural construction,
right,
but,
right,
was something basic to human beings.
I'm
so, you know, I had all,
yeah,
this influence on me,
yeah,
and so, you know, there it went.
Must have been an amazing way to begin. I'm just curious if when you were studying literature originally at university, I believe, or your degrees were in literature.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
was that in terms of what was presented in your studies, was there any openness to the scientific insights, or was that just something that you brought in?
Well, I was at Oxford, and it was a beautiful education, but didn't seem to be interested in science,
right,
really,
right,
at all.
Right.
It wasn't even hostile to science,
right. I mean,
you
right.
know, if you see what I mean. I mean, I think there was a certain... on one side of it, in terms of what you might... might think about the extent to which literary studies concern values.
Right.
I think there was a philosophical reaction among literary scholars against philosophical,
yeah,
positions that are sometimes called logical positivism.
Right. Right.
Where it seemed that the realm for human freedom and meaning had been very narrowly,
right,
circumscribed or done away with altogether. And so I think there was, and I think that was, in fact, a mistake, because I think that the great logical positivists were seeking towards the possibility of a value-rich discourse, but there was that sort of, but that was as close as the atmosphere got at,
right,
that point to being interested in science.
It sounds sort of like the two cultures.
Very much, yeah, it was,
yeah,
two cultures. Yeah, Snow nailed it pretty well.
One thing that I thought was so extremely powerful is this idea, and I could probably phrase it better, mm-hmm. but that your sense of scientific insights as showing this tremendous sense of generativity and creativity as opposed to a kind of scarcity or limitation. There was one point, I think, you pointed out that there are more potential brain states than there are atoms in the universe or something like this. And is it true that this sense of richness and creativity that you point to evolution and chaos theory as important? Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. You got it exactly. I mean, I suppose in my dad's truck and having this sudden experience of we were driving through a savanna forest.
Yeah.
And I think there were sort of wild plum trees there, and I was suddenly shocked and amazed at the sheer meticulousness of everything, every single leaf and every piece of texture of the bark, every color, all of it so incredibly well organized that it was all this and so abundant, and that it was everywhere, and it was. You know, I suddenly felt we should be amazed all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and then being a little, an arrogant little boy, I said, I bet nobody else has ever had this feeling. I'm going to tell everybody about it. So that's what I've been doing ever since. But the other thing that happened right on the heels of that was a further astonishment that there was something in here, in my mind, in myself, somewhere in my own body, was a receptor to this, that there was something that perceived all this.
Yeah.
And that seemed even more shocking, too, that there was a self, that there was an I, that there was something. I hadn't come across the word deictic before, but it was that in a very small way, I, like everything else in the universe, was the center of the universe. That the universe existed in relation to me, just as I existed in the relation to everything else.
Yeah.
And so, it was a mystical experience. And in later years, I tried to define this in a religious way, and it didn't really work. But the religions were obviously barking up the same tree.
Can you say a little bit more about that? What you just said, you tried to define it in a religious way, but it didn't work.
Well, this is complex. I mean, when my family, I was raised as an atheist communist, and my father was actually a conscientious objector in World War II, which is not an easy thing to do.
Yeah.
He didn't mind dying for the country. He worked in bomb disposal, which was one of the most dangerous jobs in the war, but he didn't want to kill anybody.
Yeah,
and they were really serious about the Brotherhood of Man, as it used to be called. But definitely there was, there was no room for the experience that I had just had in dialectical materialism. Mm. It simply wouldn't work.
Yeah.
And so at the same time, my parents were being overwhelmed by the poetic, philosophical, and moral brilliance of the Ndembu culture that we were living in, this deeply beautiful, rich, human understanding of the world. Yeah. And in particular, the ritual. that the ritual seemed to them to be something that provided the meaning that was the mainspring of Ndembu society. And this deeply appealed to their sense of, you know, human brotherhood and sisterhood.
Yeah.
And so when they came back to England and my father started working on his dissertation and everything, and at the same time, what was going on in Russia was becoming clearer and clearer, and, you know, there was the invasion of Hungary and everything else. The whole structure of the communist theory seemed to be just cracking.
Yeah.
And so they started to look around in English society or in the European context for something that would be as close as you could get to Ndembu, the Ndembu view of things.
Right.
And the closest thing that they could find, they looked at various different sort of sects and religions. On the closest thing they could find was Catholicism, which at that time was pretty traditional and heavily ritualized and full of symbolic meaning and so on. And this was just about the same time that I was beginning to say, well, I ought to have a view of the world that accommodated my experience with the plum trees. And so the whole family at that point sort of became Catholic.
Wow.
Some years later, I got fed up with the narrowness of Catholicism. Some years after that, I decided that I would have my own sort of brand of religion, but that, you know, if I could find a decent Catholic priest, then I would, you know, I would go to Mass and that kind of thing, because I believed in the importance of ritual.
Right.
There was another break, and at the moment I'm just trying to be as, how can I put it, as spiritual a person as I can.
Right.
Hope that, you know, religion is going to evolve.
Right.
You know, to make more sense philosophically and morally and so on.
There was one of the statements that I found really arresting. I think essentially he said something like, we have a nature and our nature is cultural and the culture is classical.
Yes.
Could you just tell us a little bit
about
that?
You picked my favorite aphorism of mine.
All right.
I suppose you could say that that I was opposing three, as it principles of late modernist, early postmodernist thinking, which is that we do not have a nature, that we are so purely socially constructed, from the other side, the proposition that we are basically naked apes, and so the proposition that nature is cultural, that is, it is in our physical nature to be cultural.
Yeah.
So it was sort of opposing one side and then opposing the other side. We have a nature, and so we're not a tabula rasa, not a blank slate. That nature is cultural, and then that culture is classical.
Right.
And what I was doing there was attacking two different propositions. One, that that there's a kind of a difference between folk culture and classical culture.
Right.
And the other, that how can I put this? that when we use the term classical,
right,
as it's often used, we're usually talking about European,
right.
Classical culture.
Right.
My contention was that the classical is a term that belongs to the human race as a whole,
yeah.
And there have been lots of classical cultures.
Yes,
so,
yes.
You know, it sort of, you know, the aphorism sort of bunches together a whole lot of arguments, really.
Right. I guess a really famous example of this would be the way that a 3-second line in poetry,
yes,
fits with the way that our brain works, and
yes,
that it's found cross-culturally, and that all of these different classical cultures have that kind of line, except for free verse modernism and something like that. Okay. Well, as a matter of fact, actually, would you be willing to read one or two of your poems and maybe tell us about them?
I'd be very happy to. I'll read On Gibbs's Law, because I wrote that some time ago, and
right,
and then I'll read Ride This One Out, which is much more recent, and I'll talk about briefly about both. On Gibbs's Law Gibbs's Law was the free energy formulation of the great American physical chemist Josiah Gibbs. And what he proposed was, actually, there was another Gibbs, and I may be confusing him, but never mind.
Right.
What he proposed was a formula that essentially described all the various changes of state that can happen in the physical universe. That is, from liquid to solid, solid to liquid, liquid to gas, and so on. So you'd have things like melting and freezing and evaporation and condensation and sublimation and you know, all those various things that happen in physical exchanges of energy. And it's also called the free energy formula. And what it describes is the amount of work that can be done by any physical situation, the amount of action that can be performed by any situation. So it doesn't just necessarily sit there inertly.
Yeah.
Right? So it's a very powerful formulation. And it's really at the base. If it wasn't for that formulation, you wouldn't really have been able to have the kind of theorizing that's being done about the origins of the universe, because the universe sort of conforms to that law in some strange way. And this, I think, again, is one of those miracles like the plum trees, you know. The poem deals with three observations. The first observation is something that I used to do as a kid, which was to make make crystals, where you'd have use icing glass or something like that, but you could have a hot solution of a crystal.
Yeah.
So it's just a liquid, and then let it cool down, and then crystals appear within it,
right.
And that appearance of crystals is, you know, profoundly, you know, chaos theory describes this very profoundly, and so on. It's a mysterious and wonderful thing.
Yeah.
It's a sort of spontaneous formation of order.
Uh-huh.
All right. Well, that's the first observation. The second is that this is the evening is falling, and it's got very cold outside. There's a cold snap, and frost flowers start to appear on the window pane. And so it's the same thing. But the frost flowers remind the poet of the stars, which are glowing out very very brightly in this cold night. Okay,
yeah.
And then the third observation is the memory of how the universe how the Big Bang happened, basically the Big Bang. And then there's a conclusion, which is about this very process of thinking through and associating through that becomes the poem.
Okay.
So it's self-organizing.
Okay.
And the poem is composed in four stanzas of four lines each, in which the each stanza each stanza is three tetrameters and one pentameter.
Okay.
And so you have a 3-to-1 ratio in the stanza,
okay,
but it's also the 3-to-1 ratio in the argument of the whole poem.
Wow.
So the poem itself is self-similar.
Okay.
Okay. So that's the that's the thing there. Okay. On Gibbs's law, if hot solution saturate be set upon a ledge to cool, rayed crystals will precipitate on dust no thicker than a molecule. When the slow chilling of the night crosses the threshold of the freeze, the stars shine out as sharp and bright as frost flowers in their fractal vortices. The first white gas that was the world, to ease the heat and press of birth, froze into forms as it unfurled the starry galaxies, the living earth. Such pressure drives this crystal trance, this thickening of art and hour, where order tumbles from the dance of dying syllables and forms a flower. So, yeah, I'm also identifying this same physical process,
right,
which is really, you might say, the degrees of freedom of the universe itself, identifying that with the mental processes that would go into the making of a poem.
Wow.
So the poem is also dissolving the difference between culture and nature. I mean,
wow. there's so many layers. Generativity, I don't know if that's the best word.
I love that word. Yeah.
It's really amazing.
Goethe has words for it.
Okay.
You know, sort of Gestalt and Strebung and Bildung, and Entwicklung.
And he, I'll ask you more about him later. But he was someone who was, I mean, his color theory and his, I mean, he brought that, all of that together. And has he always been someone that you're interested in? Or?
Well, no, that's the interesting thing. I mean, I really only discovered him through Zhuzhi.
Okay.
I mean, I'd read him before.
Right, right.
But, part of the problem was that I didn't read him in German.
Right, right.
I can read German, but very slowly. I read him
right.
in translation, and the translations were very bad.
Okay.
But then once I got into him, I realized, you know, this is somebody, very much a person to my own heart, a poet, a thinker to my own heart, you know. When I wrote Gibbs's Law, I didn't know didn't know Goethe at all, really.
Okay. Well, it certainly fits together well. Would you read the other one?
Yeah.
Well? Yeah.
The background of this, I suppose you could say, is a very different kind of poem.
Yeah.
but this, I think many of us have been appalled by the political descent of our country that is not only the fault of the chief perpetrator, who's the president, but also the fault of many of the people who descended exactly to his level, both on his side and on the other side. So it's a world in which part of the problem was that the progressive side had to some extent bought into the deconstructive notion that you couldn't have an objective view of the world. And once you can't have an objective view of the world, then any attempt at trying to be, to to have a dispassionate grasp and understanding of the facts is impossible. That one has to editorialize, and that this damaged scholarship, and it damaged journalism too. And it's all that stuff about fake news and so on. And although the accusers of fake news are worse than the fake news creators, so we're in that kind of situation. And, and for a poet whose work is words, this is it's like some kind of cancer, or it's like some kind of devastating tempest. At the same time, we also have a a kind of ecological situation which is possibly dire if we don't do something about it. Although what I think we should do about it is quite different from what most people do. And then also the other thing is, I've turned into an old man.
It happens.
My wife and I have turned into old people.
And
things are not as easy for us.
Yeah.
And so it's a poem about a dark situation that is done in a fairly simple way in terms of a kind of nautical sailing ship era set of images. And this is the poem.
Our guest today is Frederick Turner. And when we come back, we'll talk more about nature, science, aesthetics, and poetry.